Now, an Obama-era rule from the Department of Housing and Urban Development is at the center of a legal fight between civil rights groups and the agency under its secretary, Ben Carson. The rule was aimed at desegregating housing. Carson suspended it earlier this year. In the past, he'd called the rule an example of the, quote, failed socialist experiments of the 1980s. We've got two guests with us from the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. Bill Tisdale is the president and CEO of the organization. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us, Rob.
And Erica Sanders is with us, director of programs and services at the group. Erica, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, Bill, let's start off with the lawsuit itself. What are the claims being made in this lawsuit?
Well, the suit was actually filed on May 8th by the National Fair Housing Alliance. That's a consortium. It's of about 220 fair housing organizations from around the country. Texas Appleseed and Texas Low-Income Housing Information Service were also co-plaintiffs in the suit. That was against the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That the Department of Housing and Urban Development illegally suspended a federal rule that requires local and state governments to address residential segregation within their jurisdiction. So initially, Rob, this was an activity that HUD took on back around 2006 to hold local communities accountable, communities that received HUD's funds, accountable for activities that related to identifying impediments to fair housing. So the contract was basically that if you received federal funds, you had to undertake activities which affirmatively furthered fair housing. That included identifying impediments to fair housing. And what happened throughout the years is that there was really no accountability. And these local governments continued to receive federal funds, but did very little, if anything, to address impediments to fair housing within their communities.
And as I understand it, one of the justifications for that rule and the kind of update in 2015 to that practice was that in the past, federal housing money had been used in a discriminatory way that was allowed at the local level. In some cases, federal guidelines were almost explicitly discriminatory and promoting segregation. Do I have that right? Was that part of why this thing was in place?
Well, most of it was inaction and kind of apathy on the part of those local governments, state and local governments that received the funds. So they're I guess the premise of the suit is that they have an obligation. If you're receiving federal funds, you have an obligation to proactively identify impediments and obstacles to fair housing within your communities. They did not do that. Prior to the AFF rule being promulgated and put in place, there was impediments to fair housing, which was an analysis of fair housing, basically a study that was required for each community to do. They did very little with that either. So they either conducted the study and did nothing with the findings or turned it over to HUD and HUD did nothing with the findings. So this was, in fact, an effort with the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Act, and that provision was actually something to hold these communities accountable, putting more teeth into the efforts to get them to identify the impediments and them to also identify ways and means of undoing and breaking down those impediments and obstacles to fair housing. That was the premise, is that nothing was being done with the requirement that receiving those funds obligated them to do something about it.
And Erica, let's bring you into this now. Can you talk about the state of housing segregation in Wisconsin and in the Milwaukee area in particular?
Certainly. We know that communities throughout the state of Wisconsin remain segregated based on race and income. And Milwaukee has the rather appalling distinction of being perhaps the single most racially segregated metropolitan area in the entire country between whites and African Americans. And furthermore, metropolitan Milwaukee has the lowest suburbanization rate for African Americans of any metro area of its size in the nation. So really, we're all deprived of the benefits of living in healthy, integrated communities. Whites and people of color alike benefit from integration. But for people of color who live in segregated communities, there can be terrible costs. That segregation can mean isolation from public resources, public services, job growth and employment and educational opportunities that over the last couple of decades have been greater in suburban areas than in the central city. So segregation really functions to limit the life choices and life chances of people of color, and, you know, frankly runs counter to a lot of our ideals as a nation that we should all have equal opportunity to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and to have choices, freedom of choices, that improve our quality of life.
And Erica, is this segregation around Wisconsin something that just sort of happened economically, naturally, if you will, or is this something that policies of the past have contributed to?
I think you're touching on one of the greatest myths about segregation, and I'm glad you raised it. We do have a myth in our country that segregation evolved naturally, that people just somehow naturally decided to live with people like themselves. And the fact is, nothing can be further from the truth, that our residential segregation in Wisconsin and everywhere else in the country was deliberately engineered by public and private actors. So certainly the federal government was a major creator of residential segregation through the FHA and how loans occurred after the Second World War. Lending was much more prevalent or much more possible for white GIs returning home than for African Americans. And then, of course, we have racial covenants in which racial restrictions have actually been written into home deeds all across the Midwest and certainly in Wisconsin. And then, frankly, one of the major drivers of residential segregation is plain old illegal housing discrimination that happens in private transactions, both historically and in the present day. So segregation is not a natural phenomenon at all. It's a constructed, contrived phenomenon. And that's why what Bill was talking about earlier is so important. Because segregation was deliberately created, we need to undertake deliberate, proactive steps to undo it. And that's what HUD's Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing rule was intended to do. And that's why it's so deeply concerning that it's at risk today.
And Bill, one of the arguments from the current leadership at Housing and Urban Development is whatever we think about the causes and consequences of segregation, these rules are a huge bureaucratic hurdle for local communities, city governments, state governments. They're having to spend a lot of time, resources, and effort coming up with these reports. Is there something to that? Are these burdensome to local communities?
Quite frankly, Rob, that's ridiculous. Talking about expense to communities, these communities receive these funds based on population and demographics within those communities. That's the only reason they receive the funds, based on how those communities look and what the population size is. When Secretary Carson in particular talks about he's getting pushback regarding the expense and complexity of implementing these rules, that's hard for me to understand. There's nothing more expensive than residential segregation. Segregated communities are segregated society, whether it's housing, employment, all of those things are tied in. All of those things are inextricably linked to each other, and housing is the basis of that. Where you live determines where you work. It determines your quality of life, what you have access to as far as educational opportunities and job opportunities, healthcare service delivery. All those things are tied in together, not to mention the benefits of having each of us benefit from company of those who differ from us in language, customs, culture, religion. All those things are unique to the United States. And when you talk about an expense, there's nothing more expensive than denying individuals those opportunities to share.
We're talking to Erica Sanders and Bill Tisdale from the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. That's a nonprofit fair housing agency. We're talking about a lawsuit against the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department over this rule that has been suspended requiring reporting on how HUD money is being spent when it comes to segregation and avoiding segregation in communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this segregation in your community? Do you wish it was different than it is? Do you have questions about Wisconsin's history of housing segregation? Do you have thoughts on this HUD rule that's the subject of this lawsuit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation about housing discrimination and segregation in Wisconsin and a lawsuit against the Federal Housing and Urban Development Department. We're talking to Erica Sanders, Director of Program Services, and Bill Tisdale, President and CEO, both at the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. That's a nonprofit fair housing agency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does your neighborhood look like it's segregated? Is your community segregated? What do you think about what that means for the place you live? Have you seen a history of even housing discrimination in your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Erica, I mean, some things have changed, of course, in federal law in particular. Are things better now? Are the forces that drive segregation less powerful than they used to be?
Sadly, I think the evidence indicates otherwise. You know, as dismaying as it is to tell you, residential segregation really hasn't changed all that much in the last three decades in Wisconsin and other states. What has become what has changed is that illegal housing discrimination happens in more sophisticated and subtle ways than it once did. I mean, there was a time when banks would simply refuse to write mortgage loans in certain zip codes, or landlords could simply tell an applicant, I don't rent to someone like you, you know, based on someone's race or national origin or what have you. And in this day and age, we say discrimination happens with a smile and someone shaking your hand as opposed to slamming the door in your face. So people may simply be told, oh, sorry, nothing's available right now. Borrowers may be told, oh, sorry, you don't qualify for a loan with your credit history. Things like that. There are guises for illegal discrimination when it's happening. And while that makes discrimination harder for people to detect, and if they're not detecting it, then they're unable to complain about it and protect their legal rights. But it also means that it still has the same effect of closing a door for someone. You know, being told they don't qualify for a loan is just as harmful to them as being told simply, oh, we don't write loans for houses in that neighborhood. So while the mechanism is different and more subtle, the outcome is very similar to in the past.
I want to bring on a caller now. Andy is with us in Stevens Point. Andy, hi.
Hi. I'd like to preface this comment by saying that birds of a feather flock together. And I myself grew up in a highly segregated city with about 30% black and 60-some-odd percent white in Zion, Illinois. And just south of Zion, Illinois is Waukegan, Illinois. And back in the 60s, the Chicago bused black people to Zion to integrate them. Now, the same thing happened naturally in Waukegan, where there is a majority Latino population. And that occurs completely naturally. It wasn't some government conspiracy or government implementation of that. And I told your call screener that I really wish that your station managers would have a counterpoint, a guest that had a counterpoint to these two guests, as I really feel that they are idealists. I would ask both of them, did you grow up in integrated neighborhoods? Did you experience integrated neighborhoods?
Andy, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left, but Bill, your thoughts on what Andy had to say.
Well, Andy, I did grow up in an integrated neighborhood, and that's why I have these ideals that you claim are idealist. But I think this is a way that individuals are meant to interact. Be clear that fair housing is not putting people in places, but offering the opportunity that they make the choice as to where they live. You are not taking into consideration all the institutional factors that have come into play, which decide where people live, and that's something you need to take care to consider when making broad statements as birds of a feather flock together. Institutional forms of discrimination included individuals not being allowed to even look into other parts of communities as far as where they wanted to live, real estate companies not allowing people to have free choice to look at apartments or housing that they could afford based on the fact that no other person who looked like them were in those areas, banks not allowing people to purchase homes in areas where whites lived in, African-Americans, Latinos, and Asians didn't. Homeowners insurance policies creating grading territories based on what the neighborhood looked like. All of those factors go into play when you are talking about where people live and what choices they have in making those decisions.
Very briefly, Erica, are you hopeful that this lawsuit's going to work, this law, this rule will come back into place?
I'm certainly hopeful that it will because I think it's absolutely necessary. As I said earlier, if we are going to undo segregation that was deliberately created through a wide variety of public and private actors, we need to take very deliberate steps to undo it. The other thing I'd say, if I may interject about
just very briefly,
the idea of birds of a feather flocking together, look, there have been a lot of studies done on preferences, where people would like to live. Overwhelmingly, people of all races indicate they would prefer to live in integrated neighborhoods. But when you ask people what integration looks like for them, for white respondents in this survey, they really prefer a much lower level of integration.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to both our guests for this conversation, Erica Sanders and Bill Tisdale, both with the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council, with us to talk about the lasting effects of segregated housing in Wisconsin.